This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. A little later in the show, we'll hear an in-depth interview with a recent visitor to FGCU who spoke about his research into replacing plastics with natural materials. We'll learn if it's possible to rid our planet of new plastic production and whether or not it's economically viable. But first, as Florida legislators kick off week four of this year's state lawmaking session, today our legislative roundtable series continues with a closer look at bills that are making significant gains towards passage. These bills include those tackling issues, including where people can legally buy firearms, or carry, rather, a move to ban sanctuary city policies, an effort to crack down on the problem of texting while driving, and money for higher education, just to name a few. Plus, there's a proposal gaining bipartisan support that would require the state motto, "In God We Trust," to be prominently displayed in public schools. We're also beginning to get a picture of what Florida's 2018 general election ballot may look like, including constitutional amendment proposals that'll be put to voters. Returning to our studios for some in-depth analysis of these and other legislative measures is Florida Gulf Coast University political science professor Dr. Roger Green. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Always
great to have you.
Nice to be back.
I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 239-590-2580. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And currently, Roger, a proposal in the state legislature to increase tax and fee hikes can be approved by Florida lawmakers by a simple majority of 50% plus one. But in the House last week, members approved a constitutional amendment proposal that would require two-thirds supermajorities in both the House and Senate in order to pass any increases in state taxes or fees. Here's bill sponsor Republican Representative Tom Leak talking about that proposal last week.
Taking a citizen's hard-earned money should not be done lightly. You either stand with the people whose money the government takes, or you stand with the government that takes it.
And Dr. Green, just tell us a little bit more about this measure, specifically maybe what do critics of this move say?
Well, I mean, there are a number of criticisms you can make of this bill. First of all, just to provide a little context, there are roughly, the last time I looked, 16 states in the U.S. that have some form of supermajority requirement for enacting tax increases, or in some cases included among that is rescinding any tax breaks in some states can be considered a tax, sort of a stealth tax increase. So the majority of states still require a simple 50% plus one. Florida is seeking to join the 16 who currently have a supermajority requirement. Now, I should also point out that Governor Scott has, you know, gone on record as championing this proposal as well. The criticisms one can make, one, first of all, is that this is in many ways profoundly anti-democratic. It's not just you know, allowing a minority to essentially block passage of a legislative proposal, you know, for budgets, but it's also in a way it serves as a kind of barrier, high barrier that legislators or voters at one point in time are in, you know, essentially imposing upon the state and the citizens in the future, because it does become something that's enshrined in the Constitution. So one problem is its anti-democratic character. But in addition, as some researchers have pointed out, over the last 30 years or so, state and local taxes have remained relatively flat nationwide as a percentage of personal income. And more importantly, perhaps, there's no evidence that there's any significant difference between that in states that have enacted supermajority requirements and those that have not. So this call for, you know, making it a, you know, something that is not taken lightly. Well, it's not really taken lightly in any state. Typically, when tax increases are enacted, it happens during economic recessions and the like, in periods where there is some kind of fiscal stress that warrants a tax increase. And then typically, once the problem has been alleviated in the following years, those tax increases are scaled back. So there's very little evidence pointing toward the efficacy of these or the necessity of these, but it's good politics, particularly in a year where we have people in the in the state legislature who are likely to vie for the governor's position, and where we also have a term-limited governor who is likely to vie for the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate. Good politics.
Yeah. Interesting to note, too, there's multiple ways they could have gone with this. You can have three-fifth supermajorities,
yes,
or more stringent two-thirds, and they went straight to the
– They went straight for the most stringent, yes.
Mm. Really, this is an ideologically based decision because lawmakers today don't have a magic crystal ball. They can't see what sort of situations future lawmakers could be dealing with, and it's really – taking that decision out of the hands of future lawmakers.
Yeah, it's taking the decision out of the hands of future lawmakers. And again, in that regard, it's profoundly anti-democratic. But I should also point out that this is one of the pet policy initiatives of some pretty powerful lobbying organizations, most notably the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which, strongly favors these types of limits. But that's a strongly ideological organization. So it is an ideological-based initiative.
So if this makes it through the Senate and then actually ends up on the 2018 ballot as a constitutional amendment proposal, it'll need a 60% voter approval to pass. Any insights on what its prospects are if it makes it onto the ballot? I mean – on its face, people are like, oh, yeah, I don't like tax increases.
I think if it makes it onto the ballot that it has, particularly in a non-presidential election year, I think it could have some potential for passage. I would expect to see an avalanche of, advertising, both for and against it. But I think in terms of the way that you can do sort of a simple framing or portrayal of the initiative, for the average voter, this can probably be framed in a way that could elicit approval from a substantial portion of the state's voters, who are not going to be cognizant of the sort of the long-term ramifications of this and are unlikely to be aware of, unless it's pointed out in counter-advertising, they're unlikely to be aware that, as I pointed out, there's no evidence either of the efficacy of these or the necessity of these based on research that's compared supermajority states with simple 50% plus one states.
Right. And, somewhat tangentially related, but last year before resigning, former Senator Jeff Clemons had spoken about this and he had said, quote, "Had enough of his tax cuts for the wealthy," referring to Governor Rick Scott, "he should have to justify his corporate handouts disguised as tax relief," end quote. And I'm wondering if you think there's any kind of legitimate argument there because yes, technically, if you're proposing these big tax cuts for corporations, it's not a tax increase, but it does mean overall there's less money in that pool of money lawmakers have to draw from to pay for services to residents.
Well, I think there is some justification for that argument. I mean, look, and this is another thing I would say on behalf of the idea that this is an ideological-based proposal.
Yeah.
It would be one thing if lawmakers were to propose a supermajority requirement for any type of tax-related measure, whether it be tax increases or tax cuts. Mm-hmm. But that is not what they're proposing. They propose simply a supermajority requirement for tax increases. So it is not – I mean it's just not grounded in any kind of empirical demonstration either of efficacy or necessity. It's an ideological issue.
Well, also as it relates to how this year's general election ballot is shaping up, last week we learned that an effort to put a constitutional amendment proposal on the ballot that would restore the voting rights of former felons got the signatures it needed to get on the ballot. If passed, that means some 1.5 million people who currently can't vote in Florida would get that right back. For supporters of this measure, this has been such a long battle. Can you tell us about I guess give us some context about the current process former felons have to go through in order to get their voting rights restored and perhaps how that changed once Governor Scott took office.
Well, I mean, first of all, Florida is one of only three states that has this harsh a policy with regard to felons in terms of voting rights. I think the other two are Iowa and Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Charlie Crist, former Governor Charlie Crist, did enact in response to complaints about the draconian nature of the Florida's restrictions on felons' voting rights. Charlie Crist did enact some, you know, kind of liberalized executive clemency policies while he was in office. Governor Scott, upon taking office, rescinded those. There are in place some procedures through which you can, as a former felon, file for a kind of executive clemency and restoration of your voting rights. But the barriers to doing so procedurally are so burdensome, so cumbersome, and so harsh that only a very tiny fraction of those who have filed for such, you know, action have had their voting rights restored. A very, very tiny fraction. There has been a significant increase in the backlog of unprocessed applications. And during the same period, there has been a substantial increase in the number of felons who have been subjected to this stripping of voting rights. So the problem has actually worsened significantly over the last 10 years. It was already bad enough anyway, but it has significantly worsened since Governor Scott took office.
And given that this proposal actually does have an exclusion for former felons who are you know, convicted murderers or sex offenders, and given that supporters of this have, you know, been hammering home that, you know, a lack of voting rights is one of those things that sort of keeps former felons from reintegrating into society and contributing to recidivism, do you think that these things might be enough to maybe convince your criminal hardliners out there to support this when they go to the ballot?
I don't think it's going to be persuasive to criminal hardliners. I mean, I think this is going to be one of these initiatives that has pretty pronounced ideological kind of conflict at its heart in terms of the support or opposition. I think there are some meaningful arguments that can be offered by proponents that may sway more centrist voters. I'm not sure, given this coming up in a non-presidential election year, that might impact the turnout among demographic segments that would more likely support the proposal. And I think this is another one of these that is likely to trigger an avalanche of highly manipulative advertising, particularly in opposition, because this will be perceived as a measure that could substantially impact the outcomes of elections in Florida moving forward, because it changes the demographic composition to some degree of the electorate. It has the potential to do so. So I think this is going to be a really, really incendiary issue moving forward.
And we saw preliminary budget proposals rolled out last week. Tuesday, the House Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee proposed a roughly $64 million cut to community college funding and another $217 million cut for state universities. Meanwhile, the very next day, the Senate Higher Education Committee introduced a budget proposal on higher education funding, calling for a $383 million increase. So it's not unusual for, you know, the respective chambers to have, you know, different dollar amounts for appropriations, particularly when it comes to education. But it looks like what they're doing is going in polar opposite directions. And Speaker Corcoran has actually said he supports Senator Negron and his plans for the Senate. So kind of going against what members of his own chamber are proposing. What is this going to mean when legislative leaders have to go into conference?
Well, it could produce some really tense negotiations. I mean, it's funny. I mean, the divergence was so dramatic between the two. I think people kind of expected, they weren't so surprised by the Senate proposal, but the severity or the harshness of the House proposal, I think, took many people aback. But then just a few days ago, you know, just not too long ago, you have Corcoran and Negron going before the Board of Governors. And, you know, some reporters were characterizing it almost as a love fest between the two and kind of an exchange of mutual praise and support that seemed to downplay any kind of conflict or acrimony. So I think it could produce some tense negotiations. There's a part of me now that's wondering if, I mean, politically, the House may have come in with that really severe proposal for cuts just to potentially get some additional political leverage in negotiations, budget negotiations farther down the line, knowing or anticipating that an increase in higher education funding was likely to be a real pet issue for Negron. So this may just be good kind of strategic politics on the part of the House in doing this. But I'll be fascinated to see how that one actually plays out.
Yeah, I will as well. I was really surprised by Speaker Corcoran's comments and support saying, you know, this isn't that big of a deal, because something he's been a vocal, opponent of, or one of his issues has been what he calls mission creep. And that's where you have, you know, perhaps a state community college and then a state university, you know, within the same general geographic area, perhaps both offering similar academic programs.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't need that if they're in the same city. So I kind of just was expecting him to support what his counterparts in the House were supporting, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, and maybe some of that. I mean, some of the, you know, surprising tone and content of Corcoran's comments, you know, recently, maybe that reflects in part, again, the fact that he is likely, you know, going to be vying for the Republican nomination for the governor. So he's trying to do things that, you know, at times appeal to the base and at other times position him more favorably vis-a-vis voters in the middle. But no, this will be a fascinating one to kind of witness.
All right. And as we enter week four of the state lawmaking session, we're speaking with FGCU political science professor Dr. Roger Green for a look back at bills that made significant movement last week and looking ahead to what to expect this week. Listeners can join our conversation. Phone lines are open at 239-590-2580. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. Let's talk guns. There's a firearm bill that passed its first committee house last week. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted favorably on a companion measure last Thursday as well. And that proposes giving churches and other religious institutions attached to a school or daycare center the right to allow, you know, folks who are properly licensed to carry guns on their premises. Today, that's a crime because guns are not allowed near any schools. Tell us about this bill and maybe perhaps within the context of how similar legislation has, I guess, worked out in recent legislative sessions past.
Well, you know, in some cases, these types of proposals, and I'm saying this even nationwide, in some cases, these are a good illustration of kind of unusual or dramatic proposals that are not necessarily anticipated to produce actual kind of, you know, changes in law, but they are good for symbolic purposes in the early stages of a legislative session. They are consistent with, however, with, you know, proposals that have been made throughout the country. I mean, I think in this particular case, it's a good way for kind of appealing to the base, but I'm not sure that this is one I would necessarily anticipate seeing culminate in an actual change in law. This is one of those that I would kind of anticipate being a proposal that was designed for attractive symbolism on the part of its proponents without necessarily the expectation of producing changes.
I know, you know, rhetoric-wise, a lot of what we heard from supporters are, you know, echoes of you know, the mass shooting at the church in South Carolina.
Yes.
And then Texas as well. So there's a lot of emotional
appeal. There's a lot of emotional appeal.
Yeah. Well, let's look at the issue of texting while driving. Legislation that would make texting while driving a primary traffic offense continues to move forward in the legislature. Currently, texting while driving is a secondary offense here in Florida, meaning motorists can only be cited if they're pulled over for some other reason like speeding. On Thursday, the Judiciary Committee became the second House panel to approve that bill, which would allow police, again, to stop drivers just if they see them texting without having to have some other reason to do it. The House committee, though, they had a little bit of a different proposal when they passed it, and that includes an amendment that would require law enforcement officers to document the ethnicity of the people that they're pulling over. And I'm wondering what you think about this and whether that's something that's going to eventually make its way into a final version of the bill or if that's going to kill this for another year.
Well, I can't really envision that making its way into the final bill. I mean, the proposal itself, making it a primary rather than secondary offense, would actually bring Florida into closer alignment with what most states in the U.S. now are doing. I mean, I'm not sure in terms of actual implementation and outcomes how much of a change this actually produces in states that make it primary. I mean, bear in mind that it's extraordinarily difficult for law enforcement officers to actually, you know, monitor and see somebody texting while they're driving. I mean, I actually, that's one of the reasons, of course, why some critics have said this could likely be exploited as a means of ethnic or racial profiling, because it is so remarkably difficult in any comprehensive and uniform way for law enforcement officers to actually see people texting while they're driving.
Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, the well-documented dangers of distracted driving in general make this a real easy issue to argue in favor of.
It's an easy issue to argue in favor of, and I would be the first to agree that it is highly problematic for people to be texting while they're driving. But in terms of the actual implementation and application of this as a practice by law enforcement officers, again, it's extremely difficult for this to be applied in a uniform, comprehensive way by law enforcement officers. And that's why some critics express a concern that, you know, given those difficulties, it could simply be used as an excuse or ploy to engage in a kind of racial or ethnic profiling.
Well, let's switch gears once again. We have just a few minutes left here, but looking at House Bill 839, and this calls for the prominent display of the state's motto, "In God We Trust," in all public schools. And here's Lehigh Acres Republican Representative Matt Caldwell responding to that proposal.
It's the motto in our currency, motto of our nation. I don't see any problem with it whatsoever, and it's a foundational principle of this nation. We certainly respect and treasure the diversity that we have in this country, but since the very beginning, even before our nation was created, we've had that recognition. It's religious freedom is why people came to this country, because they felt so strongly. So I certainly think it's a good idea and would support it.
And of course, Representative Caldwell says he doesn't see any problems with this going forward. I see one, the First Amendment to the U.S.
Yes.
Constitution. Can you comment on this?
Well, yeah. I mean, the First Amendment to the Constitution, the fact that it is already on the floor of the state flag.
Which is already
in every classroom. I mean, this is, you know, and then finally, in terms of its problems vis-a-vis the First Amendment, I think that the comments that have been made and documented by various lawmakers as to why they support this have in some cases been so problematic vis-a-vis the First Amendment in terms of making it clear that there is a kind of religious, almost a kind of religious preference that they're trying to institute here through this, that it would, if anything, make it even more problematic in terms of constitutional challenges. But it's good, you know, it's good symbolism. It's good for appealing to the base. So I'm not sure I expect. I'll be curious to see how the Senate, you know, reacts to this ultimately. But I mean, at least at this point, it just seems like compelling symbolism, but something that would be highly problematic moving forward. But I do love the comments, you know, kind of, you know, the expressions of you know, affirmation for diversity and religious freedom, all while championing a proposal that
has
already kind of doing exactly the opposite. It's a great example of sort
cognitive
of
dissonance.
Cognitive dissonance and doublespeak. So. Yeah.
And interestingly, this is being proposed by a Reverend and Representative Kimberly Daniels, who's a Democrat. And so it seems to be getting widespread bipartisan support. Is this – I mean, if this passes, and it seems, you know, more likely than maybe you would have thought that it will pass, are we definitely – do you think headed towards legal challenges?
Oh, we will definitely. If it passes, we will definitely see legal challenges. And there have been some – other Democratic lawmakers who have voiced support for it as well. But if it passes, it will obviously trigger legal challenges. And again, the comments that have been made by some lawmakers describing their rationale for supporting it in some cases have provided ammunition to those who would challenge it constitutionally. I mean, it is going to strengthen their hand.
Yeah. All right. Well, we are about out of time, so I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. But thanks so much to our guest, FGCU political science professor, Dr. Roger Green. Always great to hear from you and to get your insights on what's going on in the state capitol.
Always nice to be back, John.
And remember, you can tune in next Monday for WGCU's Gulf Coast Live at 1 o'clock for week 5 of our series of legislative roundtable discussions. Coming up, WGCU's Mike Canary talks with a researcher who's found a way to replace plastics with renewable sources like shrimp shells. Find out about natural stand-ins for plastics. That's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.